Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, Alice Bryant will bring us this week's lesson in everyday grammar. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Alice Bryant.
Hi, everyone. How's your day going? This morning, the metro was loud, hot, and crowded. Again. And the train driver kept stopping and starting, so I lost my footing and bumped into someone. Ugh. I need a different way to get to work. But what? Oh, I know. I'll buy a new folding bike. Oh, wait. Or is it a folding new bike? No, that doesn't sound right. New folding bike is right. I just used two adjectives to describe the bike, new and folding. But why couldn't I change the order? The answer is that they are cumulative adjectives. And in today's program, I'm going to tell you about them. When we use more than one adjective to describe a noun, the adjectives are either cumulative or coordinative. Cumulative adjectives are adjectives that must appear in a special order to express the meaning that we want to express. For example, if I told a native English speaker I was buying a folding new bike, they might not understand me. You'll note that I also used three adjectives to describe the metro: loud, hot, and crowded. But those adjectives are coordinative. They do not follow a special order, and they have different punctuation rules. The order of cumulative adjectives is as follows: quantity, opinion, size, age, color, shape, origin, material, and purpose. Let's talk about the first one, quantity. These adjectives answer the question, how much or how many. They can refer to specific numbers, like 2 or 31, or to more general amounts, like whole, half, a lot, or several. Let's hear an example.
I'm about to order two large pizzas. Which toppings do you like?
The adjective two comes before the adjective large, and they both describe the noun pizza. If the person had said, I'm about to order large two pizzas, the listeners would have probably been confused. That's strong evidence that these are cumulative adjectives. Next in word order comes opinion adjectives, which express how we feel about something. Descriptive words like tasty, strong, ugly, costly, stubborn, and happy are examples of our opinions. For instance,
I ordered two tasty large pizzas for the game.
The three adjectives, two, large, and tasty, all work as a group to build meaning onto one another rather than act as individual descriptions of the noun pizza. Okay, now onto size. This includes any number of descriptive size words, such as large, big, and little. In our pizza example, the size large follows the established order. Here it is again. Listen for the word large after the other adjectives.
I ordered two tasty large pizzas for the game.
Okay, next is age. This can refer to specific age adjectives such as 16-year-old, or such words as young, old, middle-aged, and so on. One thing to note is that in English, it is possible but not common for more than three adjectives to describe one noun in speech or writing. In addition, not all native speakers or English experts put age after opinion. With that in mind, consider this example. The big old ugly pickup truck puttered along the road. That is how I, along with many American English speakers, would say it. Notice that I put the word old before the opinion ugly. But based on the traditional order, it would go like this.
The ugly big old pickup truck puttered along the road.
Next up, we have shape. This includes words like long, short, and round, or words for specific shapes like square. Here's how you might use it.
The ugly big old wide pickup truck puttered along the road.
That's a lot of adjectives for one noun, a rarity, but not impossible. And now we come to color. We normally use color adjectives to describe objects and animals.
The ugly big old wide red pickup truck puttered along the road.
Does this sound like too many descriptive words? That's because it probably is. All right, let's talk about the next group: origin, ethnicity, and religion. Words like Persian or Christian fall into this group. But instead of putting several adjectives before one noun, let's hear what a real person might say.
We found a beautiful 200-year-old blue Persian rug.
Okay, then there's material. Material adjectives are usually nouns that act as adjectives when used to describe other nouns, like metal, paper, and silk. We'll build on the rug example like this.
We found a beautiful 200-year-old blue Persian silk rug.
As you can hear, five adjectives does not sound very appealing. But technically speaking, it is both correct and acceptable. Finally, we have purpose. Remember back when I described the bike I hoped to buy? I used the word folding to describe a very specific kind of bike. For purpose adjectives, we usually also use a noun as an adjective. Folding is a gerund, a kind of noun ending in ing. So let's suppose I got my wish. I might say this. My pretty new electric folding bike is so much fun. I'm very happy with it. By now, you might be wondering, how do we know if an adjective is cumulative or not? Well, you can visit our website to learn about the cumulative adjective test. I'm Alice Bryant.
A tall, powerful antenna looks up to the sky from the Patagonia desert in Argentina. It is part of a Chinese space station built there over 200 hectares. A 2.5-meter high fence surrounds the area. The space station came with a promise of a visitor's center to explain its purpose. China's space program, including the space station, is run by its military, the People's Liberation Army. The Chinese Foreign Ministry says the station in Patagonia is for civilian use only and is open to the public and media. The station became operational in April. Chinese media have presented the station as a peaceful space observation and exploration tool. They also say it played a key role in China's landing of a spacecraft on the dark side of the moon in January. The space station operates with little oversight by Argentine officials. That is the conclusion of international law experts who reviewed hundreds of pages of Argentine government documents obtained by the Reuters news agency. Visits to the station are by appointment only. Experts say the United States is concerned about the station's true purpose. That secrecy also has worried those who live near the station.
The agreement to build the space station came in 2015 during the presidency of Cristina Fernandez. Opposition lawmakers questioned why there was nothing within the agreement that required the station to be for civilian use only. But the Argentine Congress approved the deal. Former Foreign Minister Susana Malcora said in 2016 that Argentina has no control over the station's operations. That year, she negotiated a new deal that required it to be for civilian use only. But international law experts say the deal does not provide a process for Argentina to make sure the station is not being used for military purposes. Argentina's space agency, CONAI, told Reuters it has no workers based at the station, but CONAI members do make periodic visits and listen to radio transmissions. But experts agree that the Chinese could easily hide data in these transmissions. Juan Uriburu is an Argentine lawyer who worked on two major Argentina-China joint projects. He asked, "How do you make sure they play by the rules?"
Garrett Marquis is a spokesman for the White House National Security Council. He said the deal was another example of opaque and predatory Chinese dealings. Some radio astronomy experts say the concerns of the United States have been overblown. Tony Beasley is director of the U.S. National Radio Astronomy Observatory. He said the Patagonian station could, in theory, listen to other governments' satellites to gather data. But he added that could be done with other equipment, too. "Anyone can do that. I can do that with a dish in my backyard," Beasley said. Argentine officials have defended the Chinese station. They have said the agreement with China is similar to the one it signed with the European Space Agency. However, the law experts who examined the documents said there is one notable difference. ESA is a civilian agency. All of the ESA governments play by democratic rules, Uriburu said. The party is not the state. But that's not the case in China. The party is the state. Reuters asked CONAI, the local government, and China's embassy for permission to visit the station. CONAI said it was not able to approve the visit, but said it was planning a media day.
The space station is 40 minutes away by car from Las Lajas, a town of 7,000 people. Maria Espinoza, the mayor of Las Lajas, said 30 Chinese employees work and live on the station. It employs no local people. Espinoza said she rented her house to Chinese space station workers before they moved to the base. She said she had visited the site herself at least 8 times. Other than Espinoza, Reuters could not find anyone else in the town who had visited the station. One local said his sister was among a group of students who visited last year. They saw an eating room and a game room, he said. Others in Las Lajas say they rarely see anyone from the station. Alfredo Garrido is a shop owner in the town. He said, "These people don't allow you access. They don't let you see." He says he believes the station is not a scientific research base, but rather a Chinese military base.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The battle between the North and the South spread in the summer of 1861. Union soldiers fought pro-Southern rioters in the streets of Baltimore and St. Louis. A Confederate supporter shot and killed a young officer from the North. Untrained soldiers from both sides fought in the mountains of western Virginia. So far, though, the fighting had not claimed many lives. But very soon, the battle would become fierce. Frank Oliver and Jack Weitzel continue the story of the American Civil War.
The old general who commanded the Union forces, Winfield Scott, did not want to rush his men into battle. Scott believed it would be a long war. He planned to spend the first year of it getting ready to fight. He had an army of thousands of men, and it would get much larger in coming months. But this army was not trained. His soldiers were civilians who knew nothing about fighting a war. General Scott needed time to make soldiers of these men. He also needed time to organize a supply system to get to his forces the guns, bullets, food, and clothing they would need. Without supplies, his army could not fight very long. There were many in the North, however, who thought Scott was too careful. It was true, they said, that Union forces were untrained, but so were those of the South, and the Confederacy's supply problems were even greater than those of the Union. The South had much less industry and fewer railroads. It could not produce as much military equipment, and it could not transport supplies as easily as the North could. In the early months of the war, Jefferson Davis, the Confederate president, did not even have guns enough for the men in his army. Those who demanded immediate action expected a short war. They said Scott should take the army and march to Richmond. They were sure that if Union forces seized the Confederate capital, the Southern rebellion would end. Northern newspapers took up the cry, "On to Richmond." Political leaders began pressing for a quick Northern victory. Public pressure forced the army to act. For more than a month, General Irvin McDowell had been building a Union army in northern Virginia, just across the Potomac River from Washington. He had more than 30,000 men at bases in Arlington and Alexandria. Late in June, McDowell received orders. March against the Confederate Army of General Pierre Beauregard. Beauregard had 20,000 soldiers at Manassas Junction, a railroad village in Virginia, less than 50 kilometers from Washington. McDowell planned to move on Manassas Junction July 9th, but was delayed for more than a week. He planned the attack carefully. McDowell was worried that another large Confederate force west of Manassas Junction might join Beauregard's army. This force, led by General Joe Johnston, was in the Shenandoah Valley near Harper's Ferry, Virginia. Across from Harper's Ferry in Maryland was a Union army almost twice the size of Johnston's. It was ordered to put pressure on Johnston's force to prevent it from helping Beauregard. General Beauregard received early warning from Confederate spies that McDowell would attack. Much of his information came from a woman, Mrs. Rose O'Neill Greenhow. Mrs. Greenhow, a widow, was an important woman in Washington. She knew almost all the top government officials, and she had friends in almost every department of the government. The beautiful Mrs. Greenhow also had some very special friends. One was Senator Henry Wilson of Massachusetts. He was chairman of the Senate Committee on Military Affairs. Another special friend was Thomas Jordan, a Confederate colonel in Beauregard's army. Jordan asked Mrs. Greenhow soon after the war started to be a spy for the South. She agreed and sent much valuable information about Union military plans. Early in July, she sent word to Beauregard that he would be attacked soon. She also sent a map used by the Senate Military Affairs Committee showing how the Union Army would reach Manassas Junction. Then, on the morning of July 16th, Mrs. Greenhow wrote a 9-word message. She gave it to a man to carry to Beauregard. The Confederate general received it that evening. It said, "Order given for McDowell to march upon Manassas tonight." Beauregard sent a telegram to Richmond. He told the Confederate government that McDowell was on the way. He asked that Johnston's 10,000-man force in the Shenandoah Valley join him for battle. He was told to expect Johnston's help. But Johnston's army was threatened by a large Union force that entered Virginia from Maryland. Led by General Robert Patterson, the Union troops moved toward the smaller Confederate force. They were not really interested in fighting Johnston, but they did want to prevent him from reaching Beauregard. Johnston knew he could not defeat Patterson, so he decided to trick him. While most of his army withdrew and prepared to join Beauregard, Johnston sent a small force to attack Patterson's army. Patterson believed Johnston was attacking with all his troops. He stopped moving forward and prepared to defend against what seemed to be a strong Confederate attack. By the time the trick was discovered, Johnston and most of his troops were at Manassas.
General McDowell's huge Union army left Arlington on the afternoon of July 16th. It was a hot day and the road was dusty. The march was not well organized, and the men traveled slowly. They stopped at every stream to drink and wash the dust from their faces. Some of the soldiers left the road to pick fruits and berries from bushes along the way. To some of those who watched this army pass, the lines of soldiers in bright clothes looked like a long circus parade. Most of these men had not been soldiers long. Their bodies were soft and they tired quickly. It took them 4 days to travel the 45 kilometers to Centerville, the final town before Bull Run. The battle would start the next morning, Sunday, July 21st.
The road from Washington was crowded early Sunday morning with horses and wagons bringing people to watch the great battle. Hundreds of men and women watched the fight from a hill near Centerville. Below them was Bull Run. But the battleground was covered so thickly with trees that the crowds saw little of the fighting. They could, however, see the smoke of battle, and they could hear the sounds of shots and exploding shells. From time to time, Union officers would ride up the hill to report what a great victory their troops were winning.
In the first few hours of the battle, Union forces were winning. McDowell had moved most of his men to the left side of Beauregard's army. They attacked with artillery and pushed the Confederate forces back. It seemed that the Confederate defense would break. Some of the Southern soldiers began to run. But others stood and fought. One Confederate officer, trying to prevent his troops from moving back, pointed to a group led by General T.J. Jackson of Virginia. "Look," he shouted, "there is Jackson standing like a stone wall. Fight like the Virginians." The Confederate troops refused to break. The fighting was fierce. The air was full of flying bullets. A newsman wrote that the whole valley was boiling with dust and smoke. A Confederate soldier told his friend, "Them Yankees are just marching up and being shot to hell." Neither side would give up. Then a large group of Johnston's troops arrived by train and joined in the fight. Suddenly, Union soldiers stopped fighting and began pulling back. General McDowell and his officers tried to stop the retreat, but failed. Their men wanted no more fighting.
The fleeing Union soldiers threw down their guns and equipment, thinking only of escape. Many did not stop until they reached Washington. It was a bitter defeat, but it made the North recognize the need for a real army, one trained and equipped for war. President Abraham Lincoln gave the job of building such an army to General George McClellan.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.